listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And my goodness, you would think that somebody dropped a stink bomb over at Fox so-called News. I mean, it's just, it's like, oh my goodness, the president shook Raul Castro's hand. Still my beating heart. Yeah, there you go. It's like, really? Six or eight of the world's leaders were invited by the South African government to basically eulogize Nelson Mandela, to give brief comments at the I don't know if you call it a funeral gathering, but, you know, whatever. He's going to be lying in state for a few days, and then they'll officially bury him. But at the memorial gathering, this giant stadium, 50,000 people showed up. Either six or eight of the world's leaders were invited to speak. Raul Castro was one of them. Our president was one of them. And as these people passed each other, they shook each other's hands. And there's this photograph now of Barack Obama shaking Raul Castro's hand. And, oh, my. You know, the right is just hysterical. They're beside themselves. John McCain comes out and says, you know, Neville Chamberlain shook Hitler's hand. I'm not making this up. He just said this. Yeah. This is pretty soon Daryl Issa is going to be holding hearings about it. Except that Hillary Clinton wasn't within 50 feet of it, so. Anyway, it's bizarre. But that's not what I wanted to talk about. Maybe it's possible that we can crowdsource some sort of a solution here, although I think that the solutions, frankly, I think, you know, and I'll lay them out, I think some of the solutions are fairly straightforward. But C.J. Werleman wrote a piece that was published on Alternet today. Look at the stats. America resembles a broken banana republic. And, you know, we've talked about a lot of this in pieces. But, you know, this is basically the consequences of Reaganomics, 30 years of Reaganomics. 33 years ago, we were number one in the world in pretty much everything. We had the strongest middle class. We had the strongest economy. We exported more than anybody else. We imported, finished goods, manufactured goods. We imported more raw materials than anybody else. We were the world's creditor, not the world's debtor. And before Ronald Reagan came into office, we were doing really well. Unemployment was only 3.6% in 1980 during that election. It's the reason why, had the hostages not been taken in Iran and held up until the day that Reagan was sworn into office through the election, Jimmy Carter would have been easily reelected. And go back and look at the numbers. But Reagan's, you know, the head of his campaign, Bill Casey, cut a deal with the Iranians in Paris to hold the hostages, and the Iranians kept their end of the deal. And so did we, by the way. You know, the Reagan administration for 6 years after that, up until 1986 when it got exposed and Congress, you know, started basically made them stop. The Reagan administration was illegally giving weapons to Iran, selling them spare parts. Why? Because Reagan wouldn't have been president without Iran. So anyhow, in the 33 years since Reagan became president, CJ says, America has become a rhino, R-I-N-O, rich in name only. He says, by every measure, we look like a broken banana republic. I assume he. Maybe it's she. I don't know. CJ. Who knows? Not one of our cities is included in the top 10 most livable cities in the world. Not a single U.S. city. Out of the 100 top airports in the world, only one of ours makes the list. Our roads are falling apart. Our bridges are falling, are collapsing. Our schools are decrepit. Our trains, none of them high speed, are running off their tracks, right, CJ? 30 countries have longer life expectancy and better infant mortality statistics than we do now after 32 years of Reaganomics. 30 countries rank their students better in math and science than we do. I mean, we're behind Slovenia in a lot of these things. So between, you know, this trickle-down economics, well, I'd say it's the whole Reaganomics package. It's the whole Reagan package, followed by the insult of absolute screaming free trade. That, I mean, you know, during the Reagan time, it was bilateral agreements, most favored nation trade status and things like that. But then came NAFTA and CAFTA and SHAFTA and the WTO and GATT and all that stuff in the following administration. But this entire arc of time, this 33 years, has led us. I mean, we have almost 50 million Americans living in poverty, and 400 people own more wealth than half of the rest of us. 400 people. I don't even know how to make a comparison, because I'm thinking, okay, you've got a kindergarten classroom and you got one kid who's got more than half of all the toys. But how many other kids would there have to be in the classroom to share the other half to make that proportionate? I mean, 400 versus 320 million? Which is 400, which would be 40 versus 32 million, which would be 4 to 3 million. You'd have to have over 3 million people in the class. If you had four kids who had half of all the toys in the kindergarten class. We have not seen this level of inequality, this ratio, by the way, since just before the Great Depression, since 1929, early 1929. Our labor has been so destroyed. You know, we used to be a high-cost labor market. Yeah, you paid a little more for things made in the United States, but A, they were good, they were durable, you repaired them rather than replacing them. And B, workers were paid enough to be able to afford them. But now we've gone from, I mean, you know, if trends had continued, people working on an assembly line right now in Detroit would be making what they make in Germany, you know, $54 an hour. But no, new hires are higher, you know, are coming in at $14 an hour. And we've got states in the South, you know, these right to work for less states that are paid 30% less than Michigan, and there's no law against their just saying, hey, come on down. Our minimum wage is a little over $7 an hour. Sweden's minimum wage is $19 an hour, and people are required to take 5 weeks of a year of vacation. So companies are organized differently because they know that their people are going to have to do this. I mean, this is like core structural stuff. But this is why IKEA has set up a factory in Virginia. It's why Tennessee has Volkswagen. Honda, BMW, Kia, Hyundai, Toyota. They've all set up in the South. We've become the low-wage country. We have become a third-world nation. I mean, I don't know how to describe this other than it's downright bizarre. But anyhow, so what do we do about it? We'll talk about that right after the break.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
How do we reverse 33 years of Reaganomics and free trade insanity on top of that? How do we reverse this and get our country back? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Nate Sweet is with us. He is a producer with The Big Picture. Hey, Nate.
How's it going, Tom?
Very well, thank you. Hope you're well, too. We're going to start out with a rant about how the U.S. poverty rate has decreased since the 60s because we decided to put into place a competent social safety net.
Yeah, you know, I think it's interesting that right now Congress is considering another, or at least Democrats in Congress are trying to extend long-term unemployment benefits. Republicans are saying no because at least they claim that those benefits keep people in poverty. But the evidence really shows that the Great Society programs, the War on Poverty, food stamps, the whole massive anti-poverty programs we've created in the past 50 years have actually decreased poverty. They've worked. They've done what they've supposed to do.
Yeah. Now let's have a conversation about ending poverty. I mean, that's something that
right.
And so anyhow, we're going to kick off the Big Picture Politics panel with that.
Exactly. We're going to bring on Huey Newsom onto the panel as well. Politics panel veteran Chris Ullman will be joining us, and I will be on the politics panel tonight as a progressive commentator. So,
which will be great fun.
Yeah. It will be excellent. We also are talking about the Volcker Rule. The Fed has voted to approve the Volcker Rule, one of the key components of the Dodd-Frank Act. This is a big moment for financial reform in the countries. Other federal agencies are voting on it today. It looks like they're all going to approve it. So we'll keep an eye on that, but we'll be talking about that as well. We'll also be talking about a bunch of Nobel laureates, including Günter Grass and Margaret Atwood, have come out against government surveillance. They've said it amounts to theft. We'll be breaking down some of those issues related to surveillance and related to corporate surveillance as well, because as many of you viewers know, big corporations are often party to some of the government surveillance that's going on right now. We'll also be talking about rent and how it's the beginning of the new housing bubble. We'll be talking about Elizabeth Warren and the emerging war for the soul of the Democratic Party and whether or not progressives are going to be able to take it back by the 2016 elections.
It's a lot.
Heavy stuff, but good stuff as well.
Yeah. And then John Nichols is going to drop by.
Right. John Nichols is going to drop by, and Adam Thompson as well, for sort of a mini debate after John Nichols' segment. We're going to be talking about universal health care as a planetary right. The World Health Organization recently said that it believes that universal health care should be a universal right and wants governments to work towards implementing that right in the next few decades. And Nelson Mandela actually believed it was a universal human right. As many of your viewers know, it's his funeral today. So we'll be using that as a segue to discuss the ongoing success of the Obamacare website. And
well, it's part of the UN Declaration of Human Rights.
Right. You know, we're a party to the UN as well. It doesn't look good.
We're in violation of our UN treaties.
Well, we're in a violation of a few of them, but that's one of the bigger ones that we need to work on implementing correctly.
It's amazing when you think about it.
Yeah. So we'll be talking about that and looking at some of the options the United States has moving forward towards trying to get universal health care for everyone.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing when you think about it that every other developed country in the world certainly is in compliance with that. And we would invade Iraq because they were not in compliance with, with the United Nations mandates on WMDs. It's like, jeez.
Yeah, why don't we get Sweden to invade us? Maybe then we'll get universal health care.
Yeah, so, yeah, there you go. Okay, and we're going to talk about death with dignity and America becoming the third world republic.
Daily take.
There you go. Good talking with you, Nate.
Thanks, Tom.
See you tonight.
Bye.
20 minutes past the hour. So what do? How do we fix this? I actually wrote a book with some prescriptions. It's called Rebooting the American Dream. And it's pretty straightforward stuff. Number one, we change our trade policies. I mean, our trade policies started going screwy in the 70s. They went seriously screwy in the 80s and totally nuts in the 90s. And here we are now, the world's largest importer. You know, basically, our wealth has been transferred to China. And not just China, but, I mean, you know, China and much of the developing world. So let's just reverse those policies. Let's go back to what George Washington put into place at the advice of Alexander Hamilton and, frankly, over the objections of Thomas Jefferson. Let's go back to what George Washington put into place in 1792 and 1793, Hamilton's 11-point plan, a protectionist trade policy that stood until the 1980s. From the 1790s to the 1980s, almost 200 years. It worked. And then it got taken apart. Let's also roll back the Reagan tax cuts. I mean, this is not rocket science. We built the biggest middle class in the history of the world by having a top tax rate on people like the Koch brothers, on millionaires and billionaires, that was 74%. Said, fine, you know, you want to take $1 million, $2 million, $3 million a year in income in today's dollars and pay less than 50% in income taxes, cool. We can make that happen. But once you get over $3 million a year, it's going to be 74%. So you might want to think about instead paying your employees, putting money back into your company, developing new product lines, growing your business. And this is why from, you know, after the great crash from the 1930s until the 1980s, CEOs made 30 times what their employees make. Now, that may not sound like a lot, but that's a hell of a lot of money itself. I mean, if the average you know, family income in the United States is $40,000. Well, actually, the average individual income in the United States is $25,000. So what's 30 times that? Well, let's see. That would be $7 million, wouldn't it? If I'm doing my math in my head fast enough. I mean, 3 times 25, you know, $25,000 a year, that's, you know, multiplied by 20, it's functionally a quarter, right? So it would be one quarter of 30, half of 30 is 15, half of 15 is 7.5. And then you throw some zeros after it. Yeah, $7 million a year. So the average CEO is making $7 million. That's, or would it be $700,000? 30 times, okay. 3 times 25,000 is 75,000. Yeah, so it would be $750,000 a year. So the average CEO in the United States, if they were making 30 times what their worker was making, and the average worker was making $25,000, the average CEO would be making $750,000 a year. That's still a hell of a lot of money. I mean, you know, you can live really well on $750,000 a year. But no, now we've got CEOs making 500 times, 1,000 times, 3,000 times what their workers are making. That's crazy. So let's bring back the Reagan tax cuts so that CEOs have, you know, instead of, and not just CEOs. I mean, it's like, you know, over at United Healthcare where Stephen Hemsley has taken over $1 billion in compensation. According to some press reports, there's over 100 executives at that company making over $1 million a year each. Enough already. And that's not, I mean, that's just one of many companies that are all doing the same thing, essentially. Let's break up the big corporate monopolies. Let's go back to enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act. Walmart is too big. It's not just, you know, ExxonMobil. I'm going to, like, sing the praises of inefficiency. Up until a year or two ago, India had a law that said that no company or family or individual could own more than 2 retail outlets. And so you had tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands, probably hundreds of thousands, of small retail outlets all over India. It was very inefficient. But what it did is it provided for a retail middle class. You had all these little family-owned businesses, and you had all these little families that actually were making a living. Just like we had here in the United States before Reaganomics. Let's educate all of our people for free. I mean, this is not rocket science. For free. Just say, here, free college education. This is not a new idea, by the way. It was Thomas Jefferson's idea, and Abraham Lincoln actually put it into place with land-grant colleges. And, you know, it stood for half a century. Almost a century, well, arguably for an entire century. Until Reagan became governor of California, ended it in California, then became president of the United States, and basically ended it nationwide. And now we've gone from, you know, tuition, the part that the student pays, representing about 20% of the cost of college education when Reagan came into office, to now tuition represents 80% of the cost of college education. because the amount that the state pays and that the colleges pay has gone from 80% down to 20%. I mean, it's just reversed itself. It's crazy. Let's make sure that everybody has health care for free. I mean, in Canada, your total out-of-pocket maximum cost, you know, $150 a month. That's it. There's no co-pays. There's no deductibles. There's no, you know, all this stuff. This is nonsense, this stuff. I mean, even in Obamacare, it's crazy. Let's clean up Medicare so it's truly a single-payer program where there's only one payer, the government. No co-pays from the citizens or anything else. And then let's make it available to everybody. Bernie Sanders introduced legislation to do this on Monday, yesterday, into the United States Senate, by the way. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And then, of course, let's encourage co-ops and let's pass clear legislation that says corporations are not people. Tom Hartman here with you, 28 minutes before the hour. Yeah, John McCain.
Barack Obama shook Raul Castro's hand. It's the same thing as Neville Chamberlain shaking Adolf Hitler's hand. And
I was there, sonny. I saw it. Get off my lawn, by the way.
Okay, Senator. So anyway, America has become a banana republic, and I have some very specific suggestions about how we can fix this. Suggestions that, by the way, are endorsed by pretty much everybody in the Progressive Caucus in Congress. I mean, it's not like I'm the only one saying these things. Now, I don't know that anybody has come out. I don't know of any members who have come out and said, let's roll back the Reagan tax cuts, because that just produces so much hysteria. But the time is going to come when the crash happens, when people are going to get it. We have been screwed by the top 1% and enough already. Just like that happened in the 1930s. And Franklin Roosevelt, you know, Warren Harding in 1921 dropped the top tax rate from 91% down to 25%, and it stood there through the Roaring 20s. In fact, it fueled the Roaring 20s. Republicans say, hey, you give tax cuts to billionaires, you're going to increase economic activity. It's true. It's the wrong kind of economic activity. It's gambling. It's bubbles. But it is economic activity. You will see the stock market jump. Until it doesn't. Because you're fueling a bubble. And when that bubble bursts, people are going to say, enough already. You know, I want to know that these folks who are using our commons, who are using our court system to enforce their contracts, who are using our copyright law to keep themselves rich, or our trademark laws, who are, you know, that they're paying their fair share. Paul in Chicago. Hey, Paul.
Hi, Tom. I had to call because I'm hearing all this stuff, and I'm hearing all about the past. And, you know, I'd have to recommend to you the saying hindsight is 20/20. And I think if you spend as much time as you do on talking about the past and how you say everybody's been screwed and take your blinders off and look at what's happening in the present, maybe we could affect something in a positive way. I mean, we got things like
if you don't understand the past, Paul, you can't do anything about the present.
You can do something about the present. You can't do anything about the past. That's exactly the point. The point is, I mean, I don't hear you saying anything about the unemployment numbers being misrepresented. I mean, most of Americans right now think there was 204,000 new jobs. A lot of people don't realize that 41% of those were the government workers going back to work after being furloughed, and those weren't even new jobs. I mean, they shouldn't include those. I mean, there's lots of people.
You know, Paul, I don't know that numbers. You know, I don't believe that that's the truth. That sounds like the kind of thing that you'd hear on Fox News. And B, you know, somebody calling me up and saying, you know, how dare you talk about Ronald Reagan? That sounds like something you hear on Fox News. And C, yeah, you know, as Bernie Sanders comes on this program every Friday and says, you know, unemployment, you know, they'll tell you it's 7%, but real unemployment, if you dig in, and those numbers are out there. You know, you've got U1, U2, U3, U4, U5, U6, different ways of measuring it. Real unemployment is around 14, 15%. In minority communities, this is 40, 50%. among teenagers in minority communities. I mean, it's just, it's off the scale. You're absolutely right. That was my point. That was my original point. I don't get it. Mary in Linden, New Jersey. Hey, Mary.
Oh, hi, good afternoon. You know, on December the 6th, there was a woman that was on 99.5 FM radio. Her name was Ellen Brown. She's an attorney and a researcher.
Yeah, Ellen has been a guest on this program several times.
Oh, good. I must have missed her. And one of the things she was saying, well, we can't fight the situation with the banks because of the lobbyists. They're too, you know, they're too,
right.
too much money there. But she, what she did suggest that we could start our own state banks.
That's right. That's right.
And
the problem that you're going to have is, although there are a number of states, California is one of them, where citizens are trying to get this passed by ballot initiative because the politicians won't, because the banks are the wealthiest and most powerful lobby that there is, both in Washington, D.C. and in the individual states. But Ellen Brown is right. If we started individual state banks like South Dakota has that competed with the for-profit banks, only took those profits and plowed them back into the state coffers, so that they could, for example, provide free education to all of their college students, and so that they could fix their roads and bridges, and so they could, you know, have a decent standard of living and put their state back together. It would be a wondrous thing. It would be a truly wondrous thing. I'm totally with you, Mary. Ellen's website, by the way, Ellen Brown's website is webofdebt.com. The title of her book is Web of Debt, and she is so spot on this. Jack in Malden, Missouri. Hey, Jack.
Hello, Tom. I'm calling to tell you about the Declaration of Human Rights by the United Nations you were talking about.
Yeah, I mentioned earlier that the United States is in violation of the UN Declaration of Human Rights because it calls for a national health care system.
That's right. Did you know that Eleanor Roosevelt wrote that?
Well, I knew that she participated in writing it.
Yeah,
I didn't think she wrote it all by herself.
Well, I think because I've seen her life on C-SPAN talk. I mean, yeah, C-SPAN talking about it.
Yeah.
She was really big in that, and she was the one that got every single nation in the world, including the Soviet Union, to sign on to that.
Yeah, well, they had a national health care system in the Soviet Union at that time.
Well, I'm talking about the human rights. That's more than just health care.
Right. You're absolutely right. It's the right to a job, which means the government should be the employer of last resort.
Also
the right to housing.
Go
ahead.
It also talks about war and
the right
about,
to peace. Yes,
the right to peace. That's exactly true.
Yep.
And when she died, you know, the United Nations made her the only citizen of the world.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Did you know that?
I didn't know that.
She was a citizen of the world?
Yeah. Eleanor Roosevelt was a truly extraordinary woman. Jack, thanks for calling and sharing that. I appreciate it. Jerry in Tucumcari, New Mexico. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Yeah, that's where I was a couple of months ago, Tom.
Oh, okay.
Hey, congratulations. Is it Professor Hartman or is it Dr. Hartman now?
I have an honorary PhD, so you could call me Dr. Hartman, although I'm not going to call myself that.
Oh, okay. Well, congratulations either way.
Thank you.
Look, I wanted you to just chew this up. I know there's a lot of caveats mixed in with this, like anything, but everybody seems to be caught in that box of minimum wage by the hour. Mm-hmm. I've been thinking that we need to move on. We need to get this country on a minimum weekly salary plus program
mm-hmm.
rather than giving employers the chance to play with hours at a higher wage.
I agree. And that's a very, very good frame for it, or a minimum annual salary. Because, you know, if you just did minimum weekly, then they could say, okay, we're going to start a new hiring policy. We're going to work three people 3 weeks a month, you know, or something like that. I mean, you know, the employers seem always to figure out a way around things. Another suggestion is one that is being pushed now through the EU, and Switzerland is actually voting on, and that is a minimum income, period. Whether you work or not, you get a minimum income, and it's enough to actually live on. So it'd be the equivalent of maybe $20,000, $25,000 a year in the United States. Every you know, adult gets that. And then whatever they want to earn in the marketplace beyond that, good luck. You know, get as rich as you want. But everybody has a minimum income. And, you know, I think that actually makes a lot of sense. Jerry, thanks a lot for the call. Rolando in Granada Hills, California. Hey, Rolando.
Thank you for the work that you're doing, Tom.
Thank you.
My question is if, you know, the bankers over here in California, they had to pay $18 billion because of the foreclosure, illegal foreclosure that they did, the Bankers America special.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a few people, the group of homeowners that joined together
mm-hmm.
in the fight, and this was by the Occupy foreclosure.
Right.
We put some pressures in the bank. So there is a way to do some work, but you really want to do the work. I heard you that you say many times, stop crying and go to work in the street. But that's what we had to do to await.
Yeah.
And you mentioned early in the program yesterday about the, we are the less society that have social activity. And it's because we really want to do everything from the couch over here. And, you know, when we got the telephone, we forgot that there are people fighting in the street. And I advise everybody in California who listen to me, you know, Occupy is allied, and we meet every Wednesday. It's mostly young people who really want to do changes, like the one that I told you, that we forced the bank to pay $18 billion.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the work that we had to do. And something that is very important, we, as you see, the mass extinction is facing us, all the mm-hmm. data.
Yeah.
Say that the mass extinction is coming. This is gone. So how you, why people like Micho Kaku, you know,
mm-hmm.
Some of these people have a lot of influence in the Dennis Kucinich. Why you we don't get together? You have to get together.
Both Micho Kaku and Dennis Kucinich have been guests on this program, and we just produced a video that came out about a month ago called Last Hours. If you go to lasthours.org, you can watch it.
Yeah, I saw the video.
Yeah,
man, beautiful. But the thing is, when we're facing mass extinction, there is no chance for any other political activity
yeah.
that we have to do.
I agree, and that's why we need a carbon tax now. We need, you know, if we had a carbon tax in place and we were to do away with all the subsidies for the fossil fuel industry, instantly the, you know, I think, A, the United States, obviously, but I think the whole world would say, okay, enough already. Rolando, thank you. Enough already with the fossil fuels. We don't, you know, having a society built on fossils, that makes no sense. Let's do like plants and take it away from the sun.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And we can do that. You know, more than 20% of the electricity in Texas and Iowa is generated by wind power. I mean, we can do that. It's not. This is not rocket science. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Sherry watching Free Speech TV in Bradley, California. Hey, Sherry, what's up?
Oh, hi. Hey, Tom. I've been trying to get a hold of you. I'm calling, and this, you know, often these subjects hit more than one thing and are all connected, and I'm calling about the 1971 Wild Horse and Burro Act, which more Americans wrote letters in than any other law to pass,
mm-hmm.
and the Bureau of Land Management has been put in charge of this. They are totally corrupted by the cattle industry, and in fact, Obama, which, you know, I'm a Green Party Democrat. I'm certainly not reporting voting for any Republicans. Ahead of our public land Salazar, who was also responsible for the oil spill in the Gulf, and all that for not watching the regulators. They are wrecking our public lands. They've been taken over by the cattle industry. They are totally corrupt. They lie. They wipe out our wild horses. They have 10 million private subsidized cattle on our public lands. These cattle wreck our soil, our native plants, our water. They cause global warming. These cattle owners are not, they're subsidized. The Bureau of Land Management will put up fences for them, will get them water. They can call up the USDA to have, this costs about $70 million. The USDA will come in and wipe out all our wildlife by burning, cyanide, trapping, shooting for these cattle owners. Some of these cattle owners, they're not struggling little farmers. They're people like the Koch brothers. have cattle on our public lands. They pay about $1.20 an acre and are not held responsible for all the damage they do. And people who have cattle on our public lands are the Hewlett-Packard Family Foundation. So they're big, rich groups. They are running.
These are great.
We want our wild horses protected. They have fought to slaughter them. They run them down with helicopters. They have taken away millions of acres that the 1971 Wild Horse and Burro Act set aside for them.
Mm-hmm.
They are totally corrupt. Mm-hmm. And I want something done about it. They're totally cruel and to these horses, live in family groups, and then they have been shipping them back to Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
These horses cost us nothing on our public lands, but they run them down with helicopters while the horses are pregnant. Horses live in family groups. They are native to North America. They evolved in North America. Recently in California, and I don't know if it's the La Brea Tar Pits, you can look it up on the internet, and I don't know exactly how old, but they found horse fossils that were like a million years old.
Right.
And horses live in family groups. They're a symbol of our freedom.
Sure, you are a great lobbyist for these issues, and you've done a fine job of articulating them on our program. Thank you. And people should contact the members of Congress and say these are real issues. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, defending America from the weapons of mass deception. And by the way, in our second hour, Steve Malzberg is going to be with us. This should be entertaining. We're going to be simulcasting his program and mine. He's a right winger. I'm not. And Professor William K. Black, Associate Professor of Economics and Law at the University of Missouri in Kansas City, is going to be with us. He's the author of The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. He's going to be with us in our third hour. So we've got a lot of interesting stuff coming up as we go through the program. Chris, in Louisville, Kentucky. Hey, Chris, you had a question?
Actually, Tom, I had some comments. And I'd like to start by saying I finished the book Screwed in September, and just amazing prophetic work, and I'm reading Crash 2016 right now, and that scares me. It really does. But I tuned in at the top of the hour, and everything you said, I agree with 100% rolling back these Reagan tax cuts and everything. You know, until we get the money, unless we get the money out of politics, i.e. lobbyists and public financing of campaigns, I don't see how anything's going to change unless we do have something like a crash in 2016. And I guess I want to toss something out here for you. How do you feel, and I guess you'd be against this, this would severely affect 501c3s, but how do you feel about a flat tax? I mean, does that make any sense to you?
Social Security is a flat tax, except that it's not. It's a flat tax for people who make under $113,000 a year. And then for anybody who makes over $113,000 a year, it's, you know, they pay nothing in Social Security taxes. But we do have one sort of flat tax. I think Social Security should be, at the very least, made into a flat tax so that Bill Gates pays the same amount into it as a percentage of his income as I do or Shane does or Jim does or anybody else does. I mean, you know, this is pretty straightforward stuff, number one. And secondly, generally speaking, for the reasons that I think are obvious with regard to Social Security. I mean, Social Security, you're paying in, you are going to get back, right? If somebody's making $7 an hour, they're still paying into the Social Security Trust Fund, even though they're not paying income taxes. They're still paying FICA tax, and they're still paying Social Security tax because they're going to retire with that money. So that's the rationale for it. But I don't think that such a person should be paying income taxes. That makes no sense to me at all. And on the other hand, if somebody's making $30, $40 million a year, they are much more heavily using our court system. They're much more heavily using our commons. They're getting much more benefit out of being in America. I think that they should be paying a higher tax rate than somebody who is just a normal middle class citizen.
Amazing.
Why would you want a flat tax?
Well, actually, I wouldn't, Tom. I heard in 92 Jerry Brown ran on it, then we had Mr. 999, you know, but...
I don't think Jerry Brown ever ran on a flat tax.
Well, you know what? I was kind of young, Tom. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but I thought he was...
I know Herman Cain did, but, you know, it's... Jerry Brown, I don't think would be...
Let me ask you this. How do you feel about a graduated flat tax? Here's what I think.
That's what we have. We have seven, I think, stages right now in our federal income tax.
But there's write-offs, Tom, and that's what these write-off things. Like for instance, I heard you talk recently about you owning a business and you can just give out bonuses to say your wife who's working for you, and you could basically pay nothing. These write-offs are really
well. The business would pay nothing, although you know I have to say it, my wife has never gotten a bonus. Or even salary.
No.
But unfortunately.
I'm sorry, sir. No. That's not what I meant.
No, but as a business owner, I can write off lunches and things like that and do actually from time to time if we have a business meeting. But
as like gambling debts. I mean, people writing off their gambling. I mean, that is ridiculous.
Yeah, you can only do that if gambling is how you make your living. And there are some people, there's a very small number of people. That probably applies to a few hundred people in the United States. But the bigger issue is all these loopholes that are just designed for very, very wealthy people, the Mitt Romneys of the world, so that Mitt Romney can go 7-8 years and pay no income taxes whatsoever on an annual income of $5, $10, $20, $30 million a year. And, you know, it's pretty clearly what happened and is continuing to happen. And it's wrong. It's just wrong. So I think we need to be closing up those tax loopholes. And I think the capital gains tax with some very, very, you know, I can't even think of a good reason to have a capital gains tax at all. I mean, basically, we have two income taxes. If you make your, and Chris, thank you for the call. If you make your living with your hands or your brain, in other words, if you work and you get a wage, then you can pay up to 39% income tax. If, on the other hand, you use money to make money, if you are an investor, if you put money out, capital, and that money comes back in profits, capital gain, so you make your money sitting on your butt around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive. Then you pay a maximum 20% income tax in the United States right now. It's 15% up until a year or two ago. That's crazy. But that's the law. So I would change that too. I would say every all income is earned income. So Sam in Woodstock, Illinois. Hey, Sam, what's up?
Yeah, actually at that physical cliff there, that thing had a chance to go up to basically the same as the regular income tax, but of course they had to keep it at half of what the income tax is.
Yeah, which is crazy.
Right.
But it satisfies the donor class.
I think you're the only one that pointed that out, too.
Pardon?
By the way. I think you're the only one that pointed that out.
Yeah.
Everybody else was talking about the regular income.
Yeah.
Now, I wanted to talk about the GM, actually, I believe just, or the U.S. Treasury just sold away their final shares of GM.
That's right. And so you can no longer call it a bailout, which is, you know, it makes me crazy. The press is still calling it a bailout. It wasn't. It was a bridge loan.
Right. And really what just happened right here, I hate to say it, the federal government, if anything, kind of sort of turned into a Bain Capital. They invested in it for the long term, which in business, that's 5 years. And... you know, and I know Michael Moore was really pointing out, like, you know, there was our chance to try and make, you know, more fuel efficient.
Well, Chevrolet did come out with the Volt, but I think the whole point was that they were going to save the company without running it. We were not going to go down the road of, quote, communism, end quote, of state-owned enterprises. We were simply going to bail them out or help them through, and that's what happened. Sam, I would not have objected to taking them over and running them, but I think, frankly, the way it worked out for the best. We saved millions of jobs. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. EdisonFactor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartmann.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartmann.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. And we're going to be joined in just a moment by Steve Malzberg, who is the host of the Steve Malzberg Show, the website Malzberg, M-A-L-Z-B-E-R-G, talk.com. Steve is a conservative talk show host. And any minute now. Oh, he's just coming in. Okay, he's introducing me. I'm introducing him. And we're simulcasting the shows, so my show and Steve's show will both be on the air at the same time for the next 7 minutes or so, 7.5 minutes. It should be very entertaining. And Steve is about to join us. In fact, why don't you just pot him up if he's
Hello, Tom.
Hey, Steve.
How are you? That was easy. How are you?
Indeed. I'm fine. How are you?
Good, good, good.
Okay, so we have the World Bank saying every country in the world should have a universal health care.
Yeah, I know, but I told you guys I don't want to talk about the World Bank.
And you've got the Pope saying, you know, we have an obligation. Pardon?
The World Bank is a snooze fest. Who wants to hear about that? Who cares?
Well, let's talk about this principle of a national health care program, of every person having health care. There are really two issues here, aren't there? I mean, isn't there the issue of, okay, you broke your arm, what are you going to do about that? Right, the individual, somebody got sick. But then there's the issue of, you know, if you're walking down the street or if you're taking the bus someplace and the guy next to you is coughing, do you really want him to have tuberculosis because he doesn't have insurance?
Okay, all right. Well, first of all,
it's a public health issue.
I don't know what country you're in or what country the World Bank is worried about, but people in the United States don't get tuberculosis.
Actually, the two tuberculosis hotspots in the United States, Steve, Los Angeles and New York City.
Okay, well, there's a reason for that, too, because we have a lot of illegals in both those places, I'm sure.
That's not the largest part of the population.
Okay.
It's poor people.
The largest part of the population, but let me finish. Nobody's denied medical care in this country, so period. The
emergency
end.
Medical
in an
care.
effort to sign people up so that you could claim, oh, we have universal health care coverage, which is never going to happen because people aren't signing up and they're not going to sign up. You're screwing with the insurance that over 100 million people have and like and depend on and can afford. That's going bye-bye. Did you see the CBS story? They finally said something I've been saying for weeks. Wait till these people who get subsidies on their premiums and these young people who could get it for $30 a month, wait till they learn the word deductible. You see, they're talking now about $5,000 plus deductibles for the average policy on Obamacare. No one could afford that. This is a disaster, Tom, a disaster.
So you're saying, Steve, that we should be giving everybody health insurance that has no deductibles. I agree with you.
No, I'm saying let the free market reign and keep it the way it was.
But oh, so you're saying anymore, that 47 million people having
people
no access to health care.
Be able to shop across state lines to other states and let people all over the country, insurance companies compete for the services of people in every state. Free market will solve all this. It always will.
Like it magically has. That's why we've had such great health care in this country all these years.
We have the best health care in the world. And you talk to the 100 million who are going to lose it in 2014, and they'll tell you, guess what? The latest polls show that 70% of Americans like their insurance, want to keep their insurance, like the liar-in-chief said we could. But we can't, because he knows, and I guess you too, Tom, know what's best for all of us. So you, Tom, will have maternity coverage. Isn't that lovely? And you'll pay for it. For it, whether you like it or not.
I thought this was a basic principle of insurance that everybody's in. Either everybody's in or they're not. I mean, that's why it's called insurance as opposed to,
really,
you know, 401k.
Everybody's in or they're not? That car insurance is that everybody you know has a car insurance, whether they have a car or not? What are you talking about?
Well, I don't have a car, but all of us.
Well, I don't need maternity.
All of us, to the best of my knowledge, have a body.
But I don't have, I don't need maternity coverage, but I'm being forced to get it.
And women are being forced to cover prostate cancer, and they don't have prostates. But so
that's
what? We just have each other's backs, that's all.
That's insane. I mean, that's the most ridiculous
thing. You actually don't have maternity coverage, Steve. If you showed up at a hospital saying, I want to see a gynecologist because I think I'm, 4 months pregnant, they would laugh you out of the hospital.
No, you're paying. The policies that are being canceled are going to be canceled, especially the $100 million with the employer mandate in the next year, or the $6 or $7 or $8 million that have been canceled. They've been canceled because they don't meet all of Obama's standards. And that means everybody has to have coverage for drug rehabilitation. Everybody has to have coverage for maternity.
Well, wait a minute. You want unrehabilitated drug addicts running around on the streets loose?
No, I don't want to have to pay for rehabilitation coverage for myself or my family if we don't need it. You know what? If I had a 67 Chevy,
so I'm guessing if you don't have kids, you don't think you should pay for schools, right?
Would you pay for collision on a car that was worth $100?
So are you saying, Steve, that if you don't have children, you shouldn't have to pay property taxes to cover the cost of the local school?
This is what I love about the left. What are you talking about?
You just said because you're
address, and then you because you can't come back with a cogent response relating to that issue. You say, oh, so you're saying in China, if they sit on the park bench.
No, you're saying if you don't need something, shouldn't.
Right,
Steve, you just said if you don't need something, you shouldn't have to pay for it. So I'm saying, okay, let's apply that to schools. Are you saying that if you don't have children, you shouldn't have to pay property taxes for your local schools?
Property taxes go for many different things.
Okay, should you be able to deduct the school portion of the property tax?
We have a system of health care in this country where two-thirds or more of the people liked the
My point, Steve,
had,
is that the public schools
the
and the public health are the same
the
issue.
They had, and now the entire system is unworkable thanks to the big hand of government who are forcing people to take what they, the government, says is best for you.
Right, from for-profit companies. You know, I Steve, I'm with you. That's why I'm saying let's take Medicare, which operates on a 3% overhead system, as opposed to 20 or 25% overhead for all these for-profit companies. And I mean, I don't understand why we're paying for Stephen Hemsley to become more than a billionaire, the owner of or the CEO of UnitedHealthcare.
I know everybody should make
so,
it the same. And
so let's just take Medicare and make it available to everybody.
You get along great with Obama. I thought we were going to talk about the fact that you said you can't be Catholic and be a Republican, which was an outrageous thing to say, but I guess that's why you said it.
Well,
that's when I approached your producer, and that's what I said I wanted to talk about. You come on with the World Bank.
I was halfway through my sentence. I was going to say the World Bank and the Pope are talking about these issues.
World Bank and the Pope, okay. Yeah. But I'm not talking about what the Pope said. I'm talking about what you said. You said you can't be Catholic and be a Republican, did you?
I think that's true.
What do you say to the millions of Catholic Republicans? They don't exist?
I would say that they're probably not practicing their faith the way that their Pope understands it.
Okay, so you know best on how they should be practicing their faith. Obama knows
No, I have an opinion.
We should have our health care.
I don't know if I know best or not. I'm not Catholic, and I'm not recommending that people do anything about it. I'm simply offering an opinion.
He can put you on the bench.
I'm simply offering an opinion.
He can put you on the bench. You fit right in. You know what's best. You know how people should worship their religion. He knows what people should do for themselves and for everybody else.
Steve, if you are trying to rebut the concept of judicial review, that the Supreme Court has become basically the kings of America. They actually have more power than any of the kings or queens of Europe. And if you're saying that they shouldn't have that kind of power, that they should not be able to strike down laws passed by Congress and signed by the president, I agree with you.
See, even though we agree, that's not what I'm saying. Even though you,
that's not what you're saying.
No. Even though you think we agree, I'm not saying I agree. I wasn't talking about that. Why do you always change the subject?
Well, I thought I was following your metaphor, Steve.
You said that people can't be Catholic and be Republican. And when I say, what about the Catholic Republicans, millions of them, you say they're probably not.
Oh, well, no, I'm not denying the reality of Catholic Republicans. What I'm suggesting is that somebody who is voting Republican and believes that they're practicing the Catholic faith is doing so in a way that's inconsistent with the current Pope. That's what I said. I'm not. That's why I said
it. It's really a mockery. Why don't you tell Muslims how they're practicing? I bet you wouldn't be doing that.
Well, I don't know. Well, try it sometime. Steve Malzberg. his website, MallsbergTalk.com. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Tom.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Yeah, Steve Malzberg, interesting conservative talk show host, brought to you by Newsmax Live, by the way. We'll be back. And welcome back. Just a quick FYI for folks who are listening to the one-hour show that we put together for, we've got a couple of stations around the country, principally Pacifica stations, who can only, because of the way that they program their stations, can only carry 1 hour of our three-hour show. And so we typically cut out from that hour all of the phone calls and the conversations that happen around those phone calls, because we do a three-hour show here, and the second half hour of every hour is pretty much phone calls. And yesterday I started out I think it might have been the first hour of the program, but in any case, pointing out this remarkable article that was published in the New York Times on Saturday, asking how many gay men are there in the United States. And it was talking about these men who were born gay, and they used an example of one, but thought everybody was. And this was a guy in his 60s, and he thought this up until he was in his 40s or 50s, and that, you know, good men just pushed down that impulse and got married anyway. And he had been in this kind of sexless marriage for 40 years. And I said, you know, the epiphany that I got out of that was, you know, for that guy, being straight or acting straight anyway was a choice. And I had been wondering for years and years about these guys who come on my program, the anti-gay guys coming on my program, or anti-gay rights, saying, well, it's a choice. And I'm saying, well, how can you say that? And it just suddenly hit me. Okay, for those people, it probably is. That they're people who were actually born gay. And it was an epiphany for me. And then I made the comment that I have known gay men, and I've known straight men. And I even commented about how as a teenager, you know, I tried having sex with, you know, I tried gay sex and figured out that ultimately I'm straight, and I was born straight, and I'm just, you know, that's me. But I'd never known anybody a man anyway. We were talking exclusively about men. I'd never known a man who was bisexual in my life. And then a guy called up and he said that he had not only had romantic relationships with both men and women, but also sexual relationships with men and women. And he found them all equally satisfying. And he said that he felt that the number of bisexuals was much smaller than the number of gays, and that they were one of the most discriminated against minorities, because there were gays who were saying the same thing as straights were, as some straight people were, who were suggesting that these genuinely bisexual men were actually just gay men who were in the closet. And he said, no, he said, I'm really bisexual. And I said, wow, now I've learned two things today. You know, that there actually are bisexual men out there, which I didn't know. And I several people actually called and shared those similar stories. And a number of women, you know, that was not the issue, and it was not in doubt. I mean, I can't speak to that. I'm not a woman. But so I just wanted to make sure that you got that, because I think that second part where I said, okay, I've learned two things today. I've learned one, you know, that probably these guys who are running around the you know, what's her name's husband, Michelle Bachmann's husband, Marcus Bachmann, these guys who are running around saying it's a choice, that probably for them it is a choice, either because they're bisexual or because they're gay, and they've chosen to pretend that they're straight, or to be straight if they're bisexual. And secondly, that, yeah, there's bisexual men out there, absolutely. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you at 20 minutes past the hour. Well, that was an entertaining conversation with Steve Malzberg. It's interesting how he keeps leaping to the, oh, you say that, therefore you must want to be on the Supreme Court. No, I don't think so. But anyway, Gary in Chicago, you disagreed with Malzberg about insurance?
Just a bit. Let me. I hope you've got some time. I'll try to keep it as brief as possible. First of all, I initially filled out my application online back in October. The site was not working, couldn't log on at all until Sunday night. The site is now working flawlessly.
Hmm.
Having said that, yeah.
That's great.
Absolutely flawless. I can get in and out, view policies, things of that nature. Let's move on to some substantive things that Steve was claiming. First of all, let me preface it by saying that I've got a graduate degree from the University of Chicago, and I had the free market system beat into my brain, okay? having said that, Steve wants a true free market system for healthcare, which, quite frankly, health insurance companies should not even be in that market because their incentives are contrary to what they should be. It should be insuring people, and the profit motive is exactly contradictory to that.
That's right. So you could argue that successfully in a nonprofit world, as Switzerland has. Switzerland has no national healthcare system, but they require everybody in the country to have health insurance, and they require that the health insurance companies all be not-for-profit corporations.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, if Steve wants to go, Stephen was his first name. Mr. Brill did an in-depth, basically it was a whole Time magazine back on March 13th of 2013, where he did an expose not only on the insurance companies, but also on the provider side as well.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of these not-for-profit hospitals, even the big ones on the East Coast, these hospitals are making $750 million to $750 million a year in profit.
Right. They're run as if they were for profit. They're just distributing those profits in a different way.
Exactly. And the profits are going to the CEOs and some of the top medical providers.
And the members of the board of directors. Well, yeah.
Exactly right.
Who are essentially the stockholders.
Exactly right. So, and there's two sides to this equation. One is on the insurance side, which is all messed up. If Steve wants a pure free market system and wants the healthcare industry, which makes tens of billions of dollars a year that basically skims off from the policyholders to the providers, if you throw that, and once again, the insurance companies have about a 30% overhead, where the government has about a 3% overhead for running an insurance program, be it the Veterans Administration, whatever it is. You throw that money, whether it's $12 billion plus the 30%, for the top 10 companies, plus the 30% overhead. Let's say they're making $16, $20 billion a year. You throw that right back into the healthcare market, guess what? You've got everybody covered in a very efficient system. But if he wants to stay with the health insurers right now the way they are, you want a free market? Put a public option in. Let them compete with the government and see who provides the best coverage.
Yep.
Then you'll see the premiums come down.
Yep, I agree. I absolutely agree, Gary. And it's the big hole, the big failure in Obamacare, for which I think we can thank Max Baucus and Chuck Grassley and a few others who were maybe Barack Obama as well, because apparently the word is that he was willing to he had already given away the public option before they even began the negotiations, which is kind of a sad thing, but. Principally, though, I think he felt that this was the only way that he was going to get Max Baucus online with us. Max really, he calls himself a Democrat, but he's really an old-fashioned Republican, and it's sad. Gary, excellent point. Thank you for the call. Rachel in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Hey, Rachel.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. You wanted to respond to Steve Malzberg?
Yes. First of all, I wanted to say that your show yesterday was fascinating. I was glued to this the entire time. It was wonderful. And I really think you do know the best, unlike Steve.
Thank you.
But what I was going to say about his comments is, he was talking about, would you get collision insurance on a car that's worth $100? And, well, my family doesn't need all this coverage. Well, the question I'd like to pose to Steve, along with all of the other people who don't think they need to have insurance, is what if, God forbid, you get cancer?
Mm-hmm.
You get diabetes? Your child has a terminal illness, then what?
Or even a lifelong disability. Have a child born with spina bifida, or something like that. I mean, it's God forbid.
And he also, I have a little bit more understanding of this because I deal with it, but he also doesn't understand that there's not just physical ailments that you can get. You can also have a mental illness set in your late 20s, early 30s, even into your 40s and 50s.
Yes.
And then what do you do?
Right. And these are all now covered under Obamacare. Yeah. And Obamacare requires mental health coverage. That's part of the new standards. And a lot of these old policies that are getting terminated are being canceled and replaced with because they didn't cover that. And yeah, you're absolutely right. And in fact, thank you for reminding me, Rachel, about his question of would you buy collision insurance on a car that's worth $100? Because that's essentially, you know, if you're going to use that metaphor, that means that some people's bodies are and lives are worth more than other people's lives. You know, who is that $100 life, you know, that we're talking about versus somebody who's got the $1 million life? I mean, are we going to go down that road of saying some people are more valuable than others?
And I think that's where he was going without really maybe being conscious of that.
Yeah.
And like the caller said just before me, I struggled with the Obamacare website. I worked on it for 45 days with no success, but I kept trying. And just like this gentleman, the site has been working fantastic for the last week.
Mm-hmm.
I've been able to navigate all of the plans. I'm going to be saving over $100 a month for my insurance.
Oh,
and I have pre-existing conditions, so I wouldn't have even been eligible for a lot of insurance plans.
Mm-hmm.
So for all of the Steves out there, take a step back for a minute and think about everybody around you as
well. But Rachel, you are the nightmare for all the Steves out there.
Oh, yeah.
You know, this is the Obamacare nightmare is coming true for them because people like you are saying, hey, you know, I can get insurance I couldn't get before and I'm saving $100 a month. That's wonderful. Rachel, thank you very much for calling. Thanks for sharing your story with us. And thanks for the reminder of that, $100 collision, metaphor. Boy, that was an odd one. Anyhow, 28 minutes past that.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And the Gramlage Bliley, we're gonna get into this whole thing of banks and investment banks. Stick around. It's the place where despair is not an option. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, helping you win the water cooler wars. And just a reminder at the top of the next hour, William Black, Professor William Black is going to be with us. We're going to talk about the best way to rob a bank. Seriously. And, in fact, that's the title of his book. And at 5:20, Congressman Peter DeFazio is going to be with us. I want to find out what's going on, you know, with the House Progressive Caucus. And there's a whole bunch of issues around this, you know, what the House Progressive Caucus's solutions are to the problems that we identified in the first hour. So, Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul. You wanted to respond to Steve Malzberg? I'm fine. How are you?
Good. You know, I'm sure your conservative talk show host friend, Steve Malzberg is his name?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. I'm sure he's a very nice man, and otherwise you really wouldn't associate with him. So that's why I'm thinking that the reason that he was acting and sounding like a flaming fool was to appease his listening audience.
Well, I don't know. He's not here to defend himself, so let's not pick on him or call him names, okay?
Oh, I'm going to pick on him. I'm going to pick on what he
said. Why don't you pick on his ideas?
Okay, I'm going to start with the first thing. Let's go back to the analogy of would you buy a collision insurance on a $100 car that isn't worth $100?
Right.
You see, the analogy, they're always comparing this to cars. The problem is people are not cars, my friend.
to paraphrase Mitt Romney, yes.
Yeah, I mean, you see, the problem is this, is that when a $100 car is in a wreck, it's totaled and you get rid of it.
Yeah.
But when a person is in a wreck and you're into the emergency room, the law says you have to fix the whole thing.
That's right. And it's a law, by the way, that was passed during the Reagan administration and happily signed into law by Ronald Reagan himself.
Right. So, yes, you do buy collision insurance on a $100 person.
Yes.
Okay, now the other part that is more disturbing is that he was so contradictory. He doesn't believe in the Constitution.
Mm.
Twice the word regulate is used in the Constitution, and it is in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3, Congress shall regulate commerce, right?
That's correct. Among and between the various states, yes.
Right, and Section 5, it says shall regulate, shall coin money and regulate the value thereof. The only place it's used otherwise is regulated is in the Second Amendment. So Congress is supposed to regulate basically
commerce
business and
money. Yeah.
Right. And so when he says insurance should be sold across state lines, well, who would regulate that, Tom? Congress, right? Well, he just said that he hates Obamacare, and who passed Obamacare?
Right, Congress.
Congress.
Yeah.
So in other words, Congress just did regulate insurance,
yeah.
And now he doesn't like it.
Yeah.
Now, besides, on the other side of that coin, as conservatives are always arguing constitutional federalism, states' rights. Well, if you're going to sell insurance across state lines, you're going to render every state's insurance commissioner worthless.
Yeah.
So you don't have states' rights when you sell insurance across state lines, because right now every major insurance company has, you know, Blue Cross of Washington, Blue Cross of California, Blue Cross of every other state. And they're all different, just like the auto insurance is different in every state,
yeah,
from California. So he doesn't believe in the Constitution.
Well, again, let's not personalize this to Steve. That argument is a Constitution-free argument.
Yeah, his argument, when I say he doesn't,
right.
I don't mean to personalize him. I'm saying his argument.
Because Steve Malzberg is not the only person saying these things.
Exactly. Well, that's what I'm saying.
Virtually the entire Republican Party.
In terms of changing it for everyone, the only other I've heard two suggestions. I have not heard another suggestion about how to deal with this other than sell insurance across state lines and health savings accounts.
Right.
Well, I think Scott Walker told us that we should all have self savings accounts, which I guess is changing things for everyone.
Yes, magically. And the whole sell across state lines, this is what was allowed to happen, I think, back in the, you know, there was a point in time before which it was illegal and then it became legal. And I don't know if it was the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, when it was, that credit card companies, banks were allowed to do this. And so what happened was states had a competition to who's going to have the least regulation of credit card companies, and North Dakota won that regulation. And that's why if you look at the back of your credit card, you will see that every credit card issued in America is issued out of North Dakota because they have the lowest level of regulation of credit card companies. It's hardest for you to hold your credit card company accountable under the state laws, which are the laws by which a bank incorporates or a credit card company incorporates. It's hardest to hold them accountable in the state of North Dakota. And that's pardon?
I said, I didn't know it.
And that's why the insurance companies are saying, let us sell across state lines. What'll happen is they'll figure out which state has the least restrictive laws with regard to health insurance companies. And you will probably find some states that will very quickly change their laws to get the entire insurance industry to move to their state. And then it's a lowest common denominator argument.
So Mississippi, we'd all be like,
that's right,
or something like that. Okay,
yeah.
I see.
Yeah, some state would pass a law saying it's illegal for you to sue your insurance company if you don't like them, or it's very, very difficult. There are no regulations that can affect an insurance company, beyond federal regulation. There's, you know, blah, 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 blah. You know, some state would just come up with the lowest possible standards because some states have fairly high standards. When Louise and I first for insurance, like car insurance, for example, when Louise and I moved to Vermont, we had insurance with Geico, actually. They advertise like crazy. When we'd had it with Geico since, you know, for like over 20 years, I got in a small accident. Actually, my daughter driving my car got in a small accident on my own property. In fact, she just, you know, kind of drove into a ditch. It was a small claim, and they immediately dropped me. And then the same thing happened to my brother-in-law when he moved to Vermont and with the same company. And I called the state insurance commissioner. I said, what's the deal? And they said, oh, yeah, they routinely do that because we regulate insurance more heavily than other states. And so they would really rather not do business in this state.
Well, commerce, what constitutes commerce has been tested in the Supreme Court, almost every aspect of it, from production to transport to, I mean, every aspect,
yes,
of commerce has been tested from early on in our nation's history. Congress has to regulate commerce. I still think that insurance is commerce.
Yeah.
Even though the stuff about the banks, I don't know very much about.
But I do. I'm with you, Paul. Paul, let me get some more other callers in here. Thanks a lot for the call. Ron in Santa Maria, California. Hey, Ron.
Hey, Tom. First thing is in response to he doesn't want maternity care.
Right.
Okay, because he's a man.
Right.
I really, really, and this is grating on me. You know, does he have a wife? Would he want his wife to have that coverage? Does he have a daughter? Would he want her or sister? But the kicker, the real kicker is, does he have a mom? Okay? You know, we need to care for, it's the perpetuation of our world to have babies.
Well, and that was my point. You know, women don't have prostates, but, you know, everybody is covered for prostate cancer. You know, men can't get pregnant, but everybody's covered for pregnancy. We've got each other's backs. What's wrong with that?
Exactly. The other thing is, and this is kind of an aside, I used to work at the similar common company that he worked at. He was a big Comcast exec. For a long time. Comcast now owns the world, I think. But anyway. Mm-hmm.
They certainly own NBC.
Yeah.
And
they're very deep. But anyway, if you think about that business, that Comcast, the cable business, they do not sell a la carte, meaning you can't go in. And I thought that that would actually be kind of a good thing in the cable business when I worked there. But go in and say, you know what, all I watch all day is, and fill in the blank, is it CNN, right. ESPN, USA, whatever, that's all I want. Well, they don't sell it that way. They package it up. Now, they do have different tiers, but right. What that reminds me of is when you go onto the exchange. They have the bronze, they have the gold, they have the platinum, whatever it is, they have different tiers.
Right.
It's being sold very similar to cable, and, you know, I don't want to say that the analogy goes all the way across the board, but
well, it's an actuarial calculation. I mean, they figure out, you know, what are people going to buy? What do we have to include in each one of these packages to get people to buy them? And okay, here's the package, here's the price.
Right, but then the bottom line is when it comes to I am an Obama supporter, and I am I believe that this will be a good thing in the end.
Oh, yeah. I think it already is.
I think it already is, too. And they've muddied the water so much that people who don't pay attention to it on a day-to-day basis, who don't really get past the talking points, and especially those who are being brainwashed on certain networks, I say to my wife all the time, you know, we got to just be careful that we're not being brainwashed because we tend to watch and listen to certain voices. Well, we could very well be in that same boat. I don't think I am. But then you could go to the Fox viewer and they would say, well, I don't think I am either.
Well, except that, for example, when Sean Hannity had on those people on his television program who all were saying, you know, how Obamacare was harming them. And then, you know, an investigative reporter called all of them and discovered that each one of them actually had not bothered to check into Obamacare and would have done better under Obamacare than under their existing programs. They basically went on Fox and lied. Hannity never corrected that on the air. And there have been a couple of occasions over the years where right-wing sites have pointed out errors of fact that I have made, and I correct myself on the air. I mean, it's been a couple of years, but I do. And it's... I think always. I mean, it's like, how can you maintain credibility without doing that? So I think that, you know, what you have there is basically a propaganda channel in Fox, and as opposed to a real news business. That's why I call them Fox so-called news.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Which is really unfortunate, but it does serve the interests of the billionaire class. And, of course, Fox News is owned by a billionaire, so I guess that makes sense. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Darren, watching Free Speech TV in Howard City, Michigan. Hey, Darren, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing absolutely wonderful, other than this blizzard that we have up here.
Oh, are you in the UP?
No, Lower Peninsula.
Okay, where is Howard City?
Yeah. Howard City is about a half hour north of Grand Rapids.
Okay, so and you're in the neighborhood of Newaygo.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, I spent my summers in Newaygo. Yeah.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, I have cousins who live there. My grandparents lived there. My dad was born there. Actually, he was born in Chicago. He grew up there.
I never knew that. Actually, I host a liberal talk show on WPRR, and we carry the big picture right before we come on.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
Yeah. First off, Steve Malzberg, why is it conservatives always want to talk over liberals?
Well, you know, I think it's just kind of the nature of the beast, I suppose.
Yeah.
You know, of talk radio. I mean, you know.
Yeah. Well, The reason that I called, at the beginning of your show today, you were talking about goods and services that used to be manufactured in the United States and they were built to last.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like over the last several years, it seems like some of those same goods are made a lot more cheaply. And I wonder if the companies are doing that on purpose, hoping that you don't get it repaired, but instead spend more money on replacing it. For example, my mother just had to replace her washing machine that she had for about 10 years. It stopped pumping the water out when it would go into the spin cycle. Her replacement, according to the people that were selling these machines, said maybe a good washing machine lasts 5 years now.
Yeah, yeah. I know. It's incredible. And, you know, we used to make good stuff. And, in fact, the boat that Louise and I live on was made in 1986. So this was like kind of before that insane change in trade policy. And it has the original refrigerator. I should knock wood as I'm saying this. The original refrigerator and the original washer-dryer. And, you know, I'm worried that I'm jinxing it. And they're both working great. Because, you know, that was back in the day when people made things to last and to be repairable.
Do you think corporations are doing that on purpose to try and keep the poor and middle class poor?
No, I think they're doing it on purpose because it's the most profitable way to do business is to make disposable junk, you know, basically. And the consequence of this, you know, if you're old enough to remember, there used to be radio TV repair shops. In fact, that was the first business I ever started, was a radio TV repair shop. There used to be shoe repair shops. There used to be tailors who would, you know, fix your clothes. There used to be, well, I guess we still have plumbers and electricians, but, you know, they used to be places, appliance repair shops, where you could get your toaster fixed or your, you know, whatever it would be. And like you said, nowadays it's like everything is disposable. I know when we lived in Portland, we had a dishwasher that was, you know, relatively recent. It died. The guy came out to look at it, and he said, you know, it'll cost less than $100 more to put a brand new one in here, and I would suggest you just get a new one. And I'm like, this is nuts. You know, this is just nuts. But you're right. Darren, thank you for the call. And excellent point. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We will be back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Let's check in with Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, and find out what's going on in the world. Brought to you, by the way, by goatsfortheoldgoat.com, where you can give a gift of a goat to a returning slave in South Sudan. Goatsfortheoldgoat.com is the only animal group that gives you a picture of your goat and the recipient. So, what's up, Victoria? Hey.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Well, lawmakers are getting close on a budget deal. What we're hearing is the phrase, I think we're close, Senator Dick Durbin saying that. Also, Paul Ryan, really more to the point, because he's one of the two co-chairs of the Budget Conference Committee, and Senator Patty Murray, the other co-chair, told reporters earlier this afternoon that she plans a news conference later today after she briefed the full Senate Democratic Caucus on the emerging deal. So we do seem to be getting a deal. Sounds like they've made the deal.
Yeah, I think so. You know, you've got three Tea Partiers out there who are, well, I think one of them is a guy who's primarying John Cornyn and a couple of others who are screaming about this right now. So, therefore, it's almost certainly a deal. Pardon my interrupting you.
No, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. No, I think they do have a deal. And it's a deal that some conservative Republicans in the House are very worried about. In fact, there are about 20, round about that number, who circulated a letter to Speaker John Boehner and Eric Cantor basically saying, look, we want a law written ensuring that the sequester number of $967 stays in place and you're not allowed to raise that number to nearly $1 trillion, which is what the rumor is that they're going to do. We want a law they can't do this.
Right.
They're so worried about it.
Right. And they want the sequester because the sequester actually gets worse next year.
it does get worse next year. That's right. And most other people don't want the sequester on both sides of the aisle because it gets worse for the Pentagon as well as for domestic agencies.
Right, right.
So that's going on. Also today, Vice President Joe Biden announced $100 million in funding for mental health services and facilities at an event with families of the victims of the Newtown Elementary School shooting. The funds are going to go to help community health centers establish or expand services for those living with mental illness and addiction. And grants through the Affordable Care Act are going to fund the hiring of new mental health professionals.
That's great.
Also, there's a loan program through the Department of Agriculture that's going to help finance the construction and expansion of mental health facilities in rural areas. They can also use the money to install new mental health tools like telemedicine programs to allow mental health workers to serve rural areas remotely.
That's marvelous. Now they only need to add one more piece to that, is since they're including addiction under the rubric of mental health, is to say that from this point forward, addiction is going to be treated exclusively by the healthcare system in the United States and no longer by our criminal justice system. We're going to decriminalize at least the most common, you know, drug, pot. I think, frankly, they should decriminalize everything, make it all as Portugal has done, and make everything a medical problem. But anyway, just my thought.
Yeah, I don't think they're quite with me on that one yet.
Yeah, okay.
But maybe in time.
Maybe.
Maybe in time. Secretary of State John Kerry and Treasury Secretary Jack Lew will brief the entire Senate Democratic caucus tomorrow on what is going on with Iraq and what their developments are. They're going to lay out the administration's interim nuclear agreement. This is a day before top Treasury and State Department officials testify before the Senate Banking Committee, which they'll do on Thursday.
That's great.
And Kerry today was testifying before the House Foreign Relations Committee. They're very keen to defend the deal that was struck with the six world powers and Iran and to make sure that no new sanctions come into play.
Now, the reason why the Secretary of Treasury is there is because the principal way that we're beating around the head and shoulders is with financial sanctions.
It's with financial sanctions, and Treasury is in charge of all this.
Right.
There are departments inside Treasury that actually are tasked
right.
enforcing these sanctions.
You're on a whole bunch of you do news reports like this for a whole bunch of right wing shows, right? Every day.
I do it for some right wing shows.
Are they having hissy fits about President Obama shaking the hand of Raul Castro?
Some of them are, and then some of them are being a bit more sanguine about it, and they're saying, "Well, it was a funeral, and he bumped into him, so he had to." But some of them are really sort of saying that this is the beginning of the end. Nobody has said it was Chamberlain and Hitler yet, unlike John McCain.
Yeah, I mean, John McCain, what is he expecting to do, slap him in the face or something? I mean, you know, it's like, hello, Mr. Yeah. You know, President Castro, I guess the two of us are going to give a speech. Let me punch you in the groin first or something.
I mean, everyone's forgotten that Bill Clinton shook the hand of Fidel Castro, who I think is worse.
Yeah, that's amazing. It's amazing.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Really fascinating.
Yep.
But that takes me to my next story, which is the Mandela Memorial, which went on earlier today.
Mm-hmm.
And President Obama eulogized Nelson Mandela at that memorial. It was an extraordinary memorial. I don't know if you got to see very much of it. It went on for at least 4 hours.
Hmm.
It was glorious, song-filled, dance-filled. Everybody was drenched.
That's marvelous.
I've never seen rain like this.
Yeah. And rain, by the way, in South Africa is considered a blessing. I know this is also the case in India. You know, if it rains during your wedding, that's considered like, you know, that's the gold standard. You're going to be together forever kind of thing.
Just wonderful.
Yeah.
Obama's speech was interesting because it eulogized and praised Mandela, but not for being what he called not a marble bust, but a man, a real flesh and blood man. He also chastised people. So for those people who were criticizing him for shaking hands with Castro, He said, there are too many of us who happily embrace Madiba's legacy of racial reconciliation, but passionately resist even modest reforms that would challenge chronic poverty and growing inequality.
Hmm. That's fascinating. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
For a marvelous report brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. We'll be back. Professor William K. Black is going to be with us. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. EdisonFactor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. On the line with us, Professor William K. Black, Associate Professor of Economics and Law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, author of the book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One, the website umkc.edu, and his Twitter is William K. Black, and we'll have all that stuff over at tomhartman.com. Professor Black, welcome to the program. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Thank you. So it looks like all, I believe it was five different federal agencies, correct me if I'm wrong, had to approve the Volcker Rule, and it's happening today?
Yes.
And
so the three banking regulatory agencies plus the Securities and Exchange Commission and the Commodities Future Trading Commission, the CFTC deals primarily with financial derivatives.
Right. And I read a news report that said that the Fed had approved it unanimously and one of those others had approved it unanimously.
And they had to do special voting because of the winter snow emergency in Washington, D.C.,
one of the agencies. So basically, my understanding of the Volcker Rule is that what it says is that banks, you know, it used to be that you were either a gambling bank, you know, an investment bank, a Merrill Lynch kind of thing, you know, brokerage house, whatever you want to call it, or you were what's called a commercial bank. You had, you know, you did checking accounts and savings accounts and mortgages, and that was it, and credit cards maybe. And in 99 or 2000 with Graham Leach Bliley, we blew up Glass-Steagall, which was the wall of separation between these two. And so now banks like Wells Fargo can gamble using your checkbook money and for their own benefit. And if they lose, then we end up bailing them out. Is that, first of all, am I accurate up to this point?
Largely, banks could do commercial loans, and that's what they did mostly, of course.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's worse in some ways than what you say, because, of course, banks don't do anything. People do things. And this is in large part a problem of the perverse incentives of the officers. And so they can do things that make them a lot of money and cause tremendous losses to the banks and tremendous losses to the federal government. And this rule tries a little bit to get at that, mm-hmm. but not in a way that pretty much anyone thinks is going to be effective.
Yeah, and so the Volcker Rule basically says that banks can no longer gamble for their own profit. They can, you can give them your money and say, please gamble with this. You know, here's my 401k. Please gamble with it and make more money for me or whatever. But they can't do it for their own account. And their CEO can't take a profit from gambling by the bank. Do I have that right?
Well, yes, except that, of course, distinguishing between gambling for your own account, which are, they call proprietary trading,
right,
and so-called hedging,
right,
is going to prove impossible.
Right.
And this isn't conjectural. Hedging abuses have been notorious for at least 50 years, and we already saw Fannie Mae in the early 2000s make a complete mockery of the hedging rules to hide ballpark $10 billion of losses, which used to be a large number.
Wasn't the London Whale, too, characterized by J.P. Morgan Chase as a hedging operation?
It is, and of course, this is the fiction, just like at Fannie Mae.
Right.
They weren't, Fannie Mae wasn't hedging. It was actually doubling and tripling down on the risk,
right,
which is precisely what the so-called London Whale did at J.P. Morgan Chase. Now, I must tell you that while we usually only worry about losses, we should also worry about wins. So, for example, one of the opponents to the rule, a former senior regulator who controlled the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, was said, you know, I've got a bank that's going to have to get out of the operation of proprietary trading, even though it's never suffered a trading loss in 30 years. Now, they mean a net trading loss in 30 years.
Right.
And that's, of course, way too good to be true. So if they've found ways to always win, you know, every day their traders win.
Yeah, then Bernie Madoff is their uncle.
Yeah, then we really have to worry about those operations even more than the London Whale operations. But
right,
the Volcker Rule doesn't worry about those kinds of things.
So the net-net of what you're saying is that the Volcker Rule, you know, was an attempt to kind of go back to something like Glass-Steagall to re-separate banking, commercial banking from investment banking, but that you don't think it's going to be effective because the banks will figure. I mean, I understand the preamble to this thing is 900 pages long.
Yes, it is extraordinary, and it's the example of the worst of all worlds in regulation, where you try to have the perfect rule.
Right.
You know, the old saying about never let the search for the perfect become the enemy of the good.
Right.
Boy, have they missed that one big time.
Well, wouldn't they, so instead of doing the Volcker Rule, in fact, instead of doing Dodd-Frank, shouldn't they just undo these two pieces of legislation that Phil Graham did that, you know, at the behest of Ken Lay, by the way. His wife Wendy was on the board of Enron at the time, or just before that. You know, Gramm-Leach-Bliley, which ended Glass-Steagall, and the Commodity Futures Modernization Act that allowed this gray and black market in bets on bets to exist. Shouldn't we just reverse out those two pieces of legislation? Say, you know, that, hey, that was Phil Graham just, you know, dancing the jig because Ken Lay was playing the tune, and you know, Phil's retired now and back in Texas, and we can do this.
Well, it's a little more complicated in terms of the guilt, which goes way beyond Phil Graham through the entire Wall Street wing of the Democratic Party. But
right,
yes, you knew we weren't serious about Dodd-Frank when it didn't have two one-sentence provisions, or they could have combined it in a single long sentence, and the first one would have been the Commodities Future Modernization Act is repealed.
Right.
That's the one that created the massive black hole in financial derivatives,
right,
which, by the way, Enron exploited to help create the fake California energy crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And the second one, as you say, is Gramm-Leach-Bliley, which mostly repealed Glass-Steagall. And that would have shortened the whole law by something like 300 pages as well. So that would have been an excellent way to proceed. And we could have simply put back in place the regulations just before the repeal of Glass-Steagall. Because Glass-Steagall had endured the death of 1,000 cuts.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly from the Alan Greenspans of the world, but also from the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, where they had made it a sort of a Swiss cheese regulatory system. And then
so,
in the complete depth. They allowed the acquisition of Travelers Insurance Company by Citicorp, which was in complete contravention, blatant contravention of the law. When you knew that, when you saw that happen, you knew they were going to repeal Glass-Steagall.
Yeah, this is sort of like the Sherman Antitrust Act. You know, has just arguably it's still on the books, but it's been replaced and sliced and diced, and Reagan just stopped enforcing it in '82. Said good luck, guys.
Yeah, that's slightly different. You are quite right, but that's the distinction between deregulation and desupervision. Right. So the law, the Sherman Act, still exists, but A, the regulatory authorities don't enforce it, and B, the courts are so hostile because of the conservative appointments, which, by the way, is a major feature we should talk about in terms of the Volcker Rule as well.
Yeah. Well, we'll do that the next time we get together. Professor William K. Black, Associate Professor of Economics and Law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, author of The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. Sir, thank you for being with us.
Which, by the way, the new edition talks about this crisis and has a blurb from Paul Volcker.
Wow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
That is absolutely spectacular. The best way to rob a bank is to own one, a book certainly worth owning. Professor Black, thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much.
And welcome back. Dennis in Marion, Indiana, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Dennis, what's up?
Hey, I have a comment, just a quick comment about your guest earlier made the analogy.
You talking about my conservative guest, Steve Malzberg?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yes, he brought up auto insurance and said, you know, if you don't want something, you don't pay for it. I mean, but what he failed to realize by making that analogy that every state in the union requires you to have auto insurance. So, I mean,
well, they only require liability. They don't require collision.
But they require insurance. You can't drive unless, you know, if you're not going to pay for it. I'm the kind of person, I don't feel I'm going to be in an accident. I'm sure there's a lot of people out there that way. That doesn't mean I can drive if I don't have insurance.
Correct.
You still have to have insurance. So, you know, I just feel it was a very poor analogy on his part that, you know, insurance is something that is required to drive a car. So, you know, insurance should be required, or is, if it is required, it should be the best insurance you can get for human beings, too.
Yeah, and the whole point is that humans are not cars, but in addition. Well said, Dennis. Thank you very much, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV in Indiana there. Joel watching Free Speech TV in Oxford, New York. Hey, Joel, what's up?
Hi, how you doing? Love your show.
Thank you.
Listen, I'm sick and tired of these conservative Republicans telling us how much they don't need big business, big government. Are you aware that Steve Malzberg is a graduate of Brooklyn College, which is part of the City University of New York, a public college?
Uh-oh. No, I wasn't, but, you know, good on him for graduating from college.
Yes, of course, but I just hate these people who they get theirs, and all of a sudden, nobody else is allowed to partake.
Well, all these conservatives running around trashing, you know, education. They're trying to reform education, right? Let's turn it into a voucher system. I would say probably the vast majority of them are products of public education. But with regard to health care, the thing that makes me crazy, and that came out in my debate with Steve, I think, was that there's really two pieces to healthcare, and the conservatives only want to talk about one piece of it. And, you know, one piece is the, I just broke my arm, or I just got diagnosed with a horrible disease or whatever. So somebody gets sick and needs remediation. But the second piece of it, which is also a strong argument for every single person in a society being insured and well insured, is the public health thing. You don't want the guy sitting next to you on the airplane who's coughing to be coughing because he has tuberculosis. You don't want you don't want infectious diseases running rampant in our society because people are not able to access the healthcare system to avoid them or to remediate them when they get them. And I think frankly it's even a stronger argument than that everybody should have the right to have healthcare. Although I think that that's an incredibly strong argument. But, the most selfish billionaire in the world, I think, would rather not walk down the street and have somebody with TB cough in his face.
Well, I would hope so.
I don't get it why the most selfish billionaires in the world are doing everything they can to prevent us from having health insurance. It just blows my mind. Anyhow, Joel, thank you so much for the call. Thanks so much for watching Free Speech TV in Oxford, New York. We will be right back, 20 minutes past the 8. The hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Congressman Peter DeFazio, representing the 4th District of Oregon, defazio.house.gov, a proud member of the progressive, very much the progressive wing of the Democratic Party and the Progressive Caucus, and all around good guy. Congressman DeFazio, so glad to have you back with us.
Hey, how are you, Tom?
I am very, 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 very fine. Thank
you. Hey, in your former domicile, Oregon, you missed some extraordinary weather. Second coldest day in history since I've been keeping records.
Wow.
10 below zero in Eugene on Saturday night.
Holy cow. Well, yeah. I'll be back there.
They closed down the government because it was a snowflake.
Yeah, I just landed.
There were, I got to admit, I had to use a squeegee on my windshield at the airport. But
Yeah. Oh, my. Well, all three of our kids still live in Portland, so we're going back there for Christmas. So
it'll warm up.
Check it out in a week or two.
Yeah.
Anyway, Congressman, the social safety net programs, Elizabeth Warren in the third way, the jobless benefits, there's a bunch of stuff going on, and I wanted to get your perspective as a member of the House of Representatives. You know how these political things play out. What's your take on what's going on right now and how the end of this year is going to play out and why?
Well, I mean, if the third way are purporting to be Democrats, I'd say their Democrats have lost their way. They first attacked Elizabeth, as I have witnessed in the press, I guess, a couple, 10 days ago or so, because she's proposing ways to make Social Security, stable for generations to come, very simply by asking for a closing a tax loophole, asking everybody to pay the same percent of their earnings into the Social Security Trust Fund. It's a bill I've had in the House since the 90s, first introduced by me and Bernie Sanders. Elizabeth is proposing similar things.
Right.
I mean, the chain CPI is cruel. I mean, it's like people are being overcompensated for inflation. Look at medical cost inflation. You know, the whole market basket, so-called, of goods that seniors buy is so different than the normal cost of living index for folks, the normal CPI has been jiggered by including, consumer electronics and stuff that are dropping in price to make it look lower than it really is. But if you look at essentials, prices are going up, and particularly essentials for seniors, which is costs of heating, costs of pharmaceuticals and medical care, costs, of gas for your car. I mean, all the kind of more essential things seniors are focused on are going up. So chain CPI is really a cruel attack on those 40% of seniors, particularly dependent on Social Security. And for anybody who pretends or purports to be Democrats to attack Elizabeth because of that, that's outrageous. And then unemployment, 1.2 million people fall off the edge of the planet. These aren't people lounging in Paul Ryan's magical hammock, too lazy to work. I mean, hey, you try and put together, a family on unemployment benefits and food stamps, which have been reduced, not too pleasant, in addition to being in your mortgage, your tax payments, and every other darn thing you have to do while you're looking for a job that you can't find, and then cut your unemployment assistance right at Christmas time. Incredibly cruel stuff.
Yeah, but Rand Paul says that after 4 weeks, employers don't want unemployed people any longer, and therefore we should not let unemployment extend. Well, certainly beyond the 26 weeks, I think, is what he said on Fox News the other day.
Well, Rand Paul has lived an incredibly privileged life, and he's some sort of physician. Good for him. But he's not talking about the reality of my laid-off mill workers in Cave Junction who just got layoff notices 6 months ago, and there's no other opportunities there. He's not talking about the construction workers, who haven't really bounced back and are now laid off because of severe winter weather. He's not talking about, struggling American families, working families, people who want to work hard, want to do better. They're playing by the rules, and they just can't make ends meet.
Yeah, yeah. It's so true. It's the word clueless comes to mind.
Well, the view from the country club, as I describe it. I mean, when you look out the window down at the first fairway, you don't see anybody out there except maybe the caddy who's hungry or struggling to make ends meet, and you just kind of the caddy's invisible to you because that's just the servant.
Yeah. To what extent do you think that things might change in the spring when all the states' primary filing dates are up and the Republicans in Congress are no longer, you know, looking over their shoulder at a Tea Party, Koch brothers-funded or Wall Street bankster-funded primary challenge?
Well, I mean, that's one of the major problems we got here. People who might be just sort of regular conservatives have become arch conservatives, were driven to shut down the government and other things. I still don't think that's going to lead us to any new consensus. I mean, then they'll be just looking forward to the election. Boehner's looking forward to apparently wanting to be speaker again, although as a speaker who doesn't control his own party, I'm not sure why he wants to do that. Mm. But he probably gets better tea times as speaker than he could get as a lobbyist. I don't expect any major changes. I mean, they're going to do this small ball budget bill perhaps by the end of this week, and that'll be it until after the next election in terms of any struggle over closing tax loopholes, working for major tax reform, tax fairness, restoring cuts in food stamps. Also will mean on their side they're not going to get to cut Medicare and Social Security, and that's all put off through the next election.
Remarkable. Absolutely remarkable. We have just about a half a minute left, Congressman. We're talking with Congressman Peter DeFazio. What would be your top legislative priority in the best of all worlds?
Oh, God, Tom, you're offering me the moon here, and it's...
in 30 seconds.
Hard to think. Well, one of the things I think that Elizabeth was attacked on, and something, I just saw something about it today, I would like to see a transaction tax, which would bolster speculative activities on Wall Street and raise huge amounts of money, which we could split between dealing with long-term fiscal problems, the deficit, and the need for investment, put people back to work, investment in education, investment in infrastructure, bolstering up social programs, full funding for food stamps, unemployment insurance, those sorts of things.
That's a great suggestion. Bring back the stat tax. There you go. Congressman Peter DeFazio, thank you so much, Congressman.
Okay, thanks, Tom.
It's always a pleasure talking with you. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Congressman DeFazio's website is DeFazio, DeFazio, .house.gov. The bad and the very, very estiferously ugly. The good. The United States of America. Yes, that United States of America. Thanks to a booming third quarter, the USA will likely surpass Germany in overall solar panel installation for the first time in 15 years. 930 million watts were installed across the country during the third quarter of 2013, the second best quarter in the history of the American solar industry as a whole, and the best quarter ever for residential solar installations. Obviously, the United States has a huge advantage over Germany in terms of overall size. 300 plus million people live in the U.S. compared to 81 million in Germany. But considering how far ahead of us the Germans have been in pursuing clean technology, this is an encouraging sign. Solar energy is the future, and it's about time the United States caught up with its Western allies. The bad. Dave Agema. The Michigan RNC, an official and former congressman, is under fire today for comments he made at a Berrien County, Michigan Republican Party gathering about why it's okay for companies to deny gay people spousal benefits. Agema said that gay people are likely to exploit the benefit system, noting that during his time working in American Airlines, he saw gay people with AIDS repeatedly pretend that they were married so they could get health care. You know, because personal anecdotes should always dictate policy. Agema added, "To me, it's a moral issue. It's a biblical issue. Traditional marriage is where it should be, and it's in our platform." You know what else is a moral issue? Making sure that everyone has health care, regardless of their sexuality or gender identity. The fact that Agema is so blinded by his bigotry that he can't see is bad enough. But the fact that he works on party strategy as an RNC official, that's even scarier. And the very, very ugly Mark Jacobs. Last week, Speaker of the House John Boehner admitted the Republican candidates were taking special classes on how to speak to and about female voters. Doesn't look like Mark Jacobs, a Republican candidate for Senate in Iowa, showed up for the class. If he did, he certainly didn't pay any attention. When asked by WHO-TV reporter David Price what the key to communicating with female voters was, he said, talking to them at an emotional level. Check it out.
Well, I think you have to connect with women on an emotional level, and with a wife of 25 years and an 18-year-old daughter, I've had a lot of coaching on that.
Plenty of practice. All right.
Yeah, I think it's safe to say that Mark Jacobs did not attend the seminar on how to not talk like a sexist Republican. Or who knows, maybe that was the seminar. Of course, there's always the possibility that Jacobs did attend the seminar and that talking at an emotional level was just what he learned about how to communicate with female voters. Either way, his patronizing and frankly misogynistic attitude toward women is just very, very ugly. That's incredibly ugly. Okay, Gus in New York City. Hey, Gus, you don't think the minimum wage should go up? Do I have that right?
Well, it's an interesting question, Tom, because, you know, really we want people to get a livable wage, but what about the businesses that aren't making profit or that are just struggling by?
They'll go out of business.
And
they should.
Right, they're going to go out of business.
And they should. If your business model is to pay your employees so badly that they can't live, you should not be doing business in the United States of America.
Well, suppose it was going good for like 20 years and you're just trying to, you know, get by and you have to reduce wages for a while. I mean, my question
businesses
is,
deal with that kind of thing all the time, Gus. If you're having a bad year out of a whole bunch of profitable years, and by the way, McDonald's is not. Their CEOs is making more than has ever been made, and they're showing huge profits. They could easily pay their employees a living wage and still make a profit. But, you know, and not
right,
just McDonald's, the Walmart. I mean, you got the four Walmart heirs own more wealth than the 40% than the bottom 40% of all Americans, which is probably, you know, 75% of all the low wage workers in the country. Just those, you know,
exactly.
Five or six individuals have more wealth. So, you know, they could easily pay these people a decent wage. But if your business, you know, if your business is having a bad year, that's what banks are for.
Well, Tom, I agree with you. I think that the problem is that the companies that are making the big profits but not paying the wages is the problem. Why are we going after businesses that are just shoveling away these profits at the expense of everybody else? Because we're
well, in most cases,
them with our with welfare and housing and food stamps.
Yeah, in most cases where you have individual municipalities or you know areas that, for example, here in Washington D.C. You know, they were going to raise the minimum wage to $15, but it only applied to stores that were over, what, 30 or 40,000 square feet and only applied to companies that had, you know, gross revenues over a certain threshold. So basically it was just, you know, it was targeting the big chains. And, you know, small mom and pop shops could continue to pay whatever they pay. But the fact of the matter is that when you look at wages in America, what you find is that by and large, small mom and pop shops don't pay minimum wage. They pay much better than minimum wage. Because the owner is working side by side with the employees, and they couldn't look those people in the eye if they paid them $7 an hour.
Right, but the problem is that if we raise the minimum wage without looking at the profitability of the company, those companies are going to just raise their prices, which is going to have ripple effects on all the mom and pop businesses.
Not true. It's never been true. We've had the minimum wage. Now, Gus, you're repeating Fox News nonsense. We've had the minimum wage since 1935. It has been raised over and over and over and over again. If there was ever, and not only that, you've got states and cities around the United States that are $1, $2, as much as almost $3 over the federal minimum wage, and they've raised their minimum wages. And you would think in the, you know, what is it? How many years has it been since 1935? It's been roughly, what, 80 years? You would think in the 80 years or so from the time that the minimum wage was put into place until today, if there was even one example of employers going out of business or an economy going down rather than up as a result of the minimum wage being increased, that would be what Sean Hannity would be talking about every night. You know, back in 1947, when they raised the minimum wage in Flint, Michigan, all of a sudden, Acme Tool and Die had to go out of business. But there is no example. What happens when the minimum wage goes up is that the amount of money in the pockets of working people who spend 100% of their income goes up. So they spend that money into the local economy, which stimulates the economy more than it costs in wages. Wages are a small part of the cost of any product. You know, maybe 5 cents, 5%, 10%, 15% is really, really high for a labor cost for pretty much anything. And so if you are increasing your labor costs by 2% or 3%, then you might be increasing your product cost if you were trying to drop all of that to the product bottom line by, you know, a half a percent or a quarter of a percent. And that kind of a price increase, A, most people aren't going to notice, but B, you could also absorb that by simply reducing the dividend that you're paying to your stockholders or reducing your CEO's absurd pay, who's making 500 times what his workers are making, and going back to the way it was from 1935 to the Reagan era when the CEOs made 30 times what their workers make.
Well, I agree, but I believe that it's less direct than taxing the rich. I think we
should do both.
You know, it's the profit.
Let's roll back the Reagan tax cuts,
okay, but,
and let's peg the minimum wage at least to where it was at in 1968. In 1968, it was at $10.10 an hour in today's dollars. Let's put it back there. What's wrong with that?
Well, I just think the Republicans have insulated themselves too well against the idea of raising taxes. It's just working so perfectly. It's disgusting.
Yeah, it's and it will work perfectly until all hell breaks loose. When the bottom falls out of this market and we find ourselves in a Great Depression, the Republicans are going to be running around going, it was all Obama's fault, Obama did it. But everybody knows by now. Everybody knows. The Republicans are going to run around going, you know, screw the working class, low wages, no unions, you know, oh, but we got to help out the banksters and, you know, let's go do away with the Volcker Rule, let's deregulate the banksters and let's do away with regulations so that the Koch brothers can pollute more and all that kind of stuff. Everybody gets it. And the time is going to come in the United States, as it did in 1935, or 34, really, I believe it was, when people are saying, you know, the previous president dropped that top tax rate down to 25%, Harding did in 1921, and or in the case of Reagan down to 28%. You know, the previous Republicans had dropped that tax, but we're going to jack it up. They took it up to 91%, and it stood there from the 1930s until the 1960s. And then it got dropped down to 74% to fill in all the loopholes, but wealthy people actually were paying more after LBJ got done, quote, cutting the top marginal tax rate than they were before. And it stood at 74% until Reagan came along. And we had a stable economy as a consequence of that. And the people get this. Average working people get this. And so the time is going to come. I'm telling you, Gus, the time is going to come when people are going to say, enough already. We've had enough. And no amount of redistricting and no amount of voter ID laws. And, you know, even in Texas where, you know, women have to, by law, have their maiden name on their driver's license, but their voter registration is under a different name. And so they're all going to, virtually all the women in Texas, married women in Texas anyway, are going to have to provisionally vote or sign some sort of weird voucher. And there's going to be long lines. All this. You know, no amount of voter suppression is going to be able to keep for the Republicans to be able to keep that kind of discipline. I see the day when it's going to collapse, Gus. I really do. So
yeah, well, I hope it's not too late. You know, I wish that you would challenge Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity to a debate on whether or not tax cuts for the rich create jobs.
Oh, I have, and you know, the last time I was on Fox, I was on Bill O'Reilly's show, and they have deigned not to have me back for I think fairly obvious reasons. And Limbaugh never would debate a progressive because he'd lose. I mean, you know, debate the facts, really, and you can make a good living just spewing nonsense. 15 minutes before you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And our app, our free app over at TomHartman.com and in the App Store. Great fun. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Carol in Cornville, Arizona, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Carol, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I am an Army brat, a grown-up adult of the military, and we had awesome health care. Why couldn't we combine the military single-pay healthcare system with what we've got in the private sector and go about it that way?
Because the military system is socialist, and you're not going to get Republicans to vote for that unless it's in the military. If it works really good, I mean, Republicans are saying, okay, this kind of healthcare works really good, and so we'll give it to the military because Republicans always salute the military. But it's actually socialist medicine. The military healthcare systems, the VA system and the system within the Army itself for active duty is actually owned by the government. So it's very much like the United Kingdom system. It's a socialist system as opposed to a single-payer system like Medicare is, or a mixed system like, you know, arguably Medicare is, Medicaid and some of these other systems. So I don't mean to be glib, Carol. I think it's a...
I'm confused.
Okay. I think it's a great idea. I think what you're suggesting is a great idea, but it's not going to happen because the military health care is, if you're in the Army, the health care that you get is from doctors who are employees of the government, and you go into a facility which is owned and built by the government. That's, you know, when you have a medical system that is owned and run by the government, that is called socialized medicine. And so the military system was socialist medicine, socialized medicine, which is what they have in the United Kingdom. The United Kingdom, the government owns the National Health Service, and they run the National Health Service, and all the doctors and hospital employees and everybody, they're employees of the federal government. And even a lot of Democrats in America would not vote for socialist medicine.
But with all the money that we pour into the military, does that make sense?
No, your point that it's the best form of medicine and that it worked wonderfully is absolutely right. And we should do something like what you're suggesting. I'm saying that it's politically impossible because the Republican Party will do the right thing, that is socialized medicine. They'll do the right thing for the Army or the Navy or the Marine Corps or whatever. But they won't do the right thing for the average American worker, the average American citizen. Because when they do it for the Army, they can call it military spending and they can salute the flag and they can pretend that they're patriotic. But when they do it for average working people, then it's called socialized medicine, and they just won't go there.
Then we just need to get rid of the Republican Party.
Well, there you go, and that's why elections, you know, seriously, elections have consequences, and we have an election that's coming up in what, 11 months now, and roughly, and it's going to be a really important election because it's going to determine whether or not the House of Representatives is going to continue to be held by the Republican Party, or whether the Democrats are going to take it back. And it's going to be a really tough election because of all this gerrymandering. So it is time to get very politically involved. Carol, thank you for the call, and thanks for sharing your story with us. You are so spot on. You are absolutely right. Thank you. We'll be right back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Harmon here with you. Adam in Minneapolis. Hey, Adam, thanks for listening to AM950. What's up?
Hey, Tom.
Hey, Adam.
Hey, I love your show, and thanks for having me on. You know, I can't remember what you said earlier, but it was early on in the show that you mentioned something about, you know, raising revenues, and I just wanted to share an idea I had with you, which was to create a progressive capital gains tax.
Well, the capital gains tax is already progressive. If you have capital gains and you only make $15,000 a year, but it was all capital gains, you don't pay any tax. You don't pay any income tax. Just like if you had, I don't know what the bottom level is, but let's say $5,000 a year, something like that. So, you know, genuine hardcore poverty. You don't pay any tax, whether it's capital gains or whether it's regular income. It's a graduated tax.
Oh, okay. Is it just the two levels then?
No, there's a bunch of levels, and I don't, you know. I don't know enough about the tax law to speak, you know, with any information about it. And B, I'm not, you know, like any kind of big time investor who actually pays capital gains tax. In fact, I would right. probably on any Very given year pay a capital loss tax if there was one. So I don't know. But what I do know is that the capital gains tax is progressive just like the regular income taxes. And I think that the categories are tied together. I think that, you know, the income levels where a jump happens in the regular income tax are the same places where a jump happens in the capital gains tax. And that way, if you've got somebody who's retired, for example, and they're right. living on Social Security, plus they've got some stocks stashed away, and they're making money from selling the stocks or from dividends or things like that, they pay a capital gains rate that's much lower than Warren Buffett might. You know, although he's figured out ways to pay very little taxes too.
Right. Yeah, it's easier to do when you have more money to hire lawyers and accountants.
Yep.
And all of that.
And lobbyists to write the laws that give you the loopholes. But good point, Adam. Thank you for the call and thanks for listening. AM 950. Tom in South Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hey, Tom.
Hey, Tom. Great show.
Thank you. You wanted to talk about the free market?
My comment was in regards to your previous conservative guest you had on and healthcare. Mm-hmm. What I don't understand it is how he kept talking about the free market, and in the same breath, he basically said that, you know, if you don't have insurance, you get to access all the healthcare, not all of it, but you still get access to healthcare regardless if you have insurance, which to me doesn't make any sense.
Right. Yeah, it doesn't. You know, it doesn't to me either.
Yeah, and if you think about it, I mean, what other product or service out there can you basically dial a universal three-digit number, have trained professionals rush out to you, basically provide you care, and then rush you to a hospital and where they take care of you again? No questions asked. I mean, you can't do that with a TV set. You can't do that with furniture. You can't do that with anything else. So,
right.
I mean, I just think his logic is flawed.
Yeah, I agree. You can do that with your house on fire and in all but a very few municipalities in the United States. And I think that that's probably the best metaphor is, you know, we all pay for the fire department. We all pay for basically fire insurance. And we don't complain about that. We think it's a reasonable thing. Aren't our bodies at least as valuable as our houses? And I think that the answer is clearly yes. Tom, thanks for the call. Excellent question. Susan, in Palmyra, New York? Am I saying that right,
Susan? Palmyra, New York.
Okay.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What's up?
Good to talk to you. I just wanted to talk about the minimum wage. I get so irate when I hear that it's going to cause all kinds of problems if it is raised.
Mm-hmm.
My husband and I had a small business years ago, and we paid our help first. We paid our help first, then we paid our bills, and we took what was left.
That's right. I mean, the first 3 years that we did this radio show, Louise and I took nothing, zero. And we did have employees, and we did pay those employees.
Right. And, you know, our business ended up, we weren't able to keep it, but it was absolutely not because we paid our help well.
Yeah, yeah.
But our help was our most important asset.
Mm-hmm.
It was an auto repair business, and if you don't have
good mechanics, you got nothing. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And you know, we paid health. This was years ago. We paid health insurance for them,
mm-hmm.
and we wanted to keep our employees.
Right.
And I just get so angry that today we have so many people working so hard for so little money.
Yeah.
That's all I want to say.
You said it very well. Susan, thank you for calling, and thank you for sharing that. It's a brilliant comment. Joe in Northampton, Mass., listening on WHMP. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Dr. Hartman, oh, my gosh, it's so great to talk to you.
Well, thank you, Joe.
And great to listen to you. I want you to give us an app where we can go and ask Tom Hartman a question anytime we can.
Yeah, good luck with that.
I'd like that app, please. Listen, here's a point. I've been holding this for 3 years. I've been meaning to call when Bernie is on. One of the two of you knows the answer to this, and I think it's a really important one. We shop at Walmart because we want the cheapest price, given what's happening with the world and our economy. the argument that I never heard posed, even on your show, was, okay, you spend, let's say, $8,000 a year for insurance. If we get rid of the insurance, we're going to have to raise taxes. But there's a difference. I don't think we'll spend $8,000 more for taxes.
That's correct. We would spend about $5,000.
Wow, that's $3,000 based on our society. That's the number that ought to be out there.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I mean, and this argument was made back when and has been made a number of times about, you know, arguing for single payer or at the very least for a public option. Is that Medicare operates with 3% overhead, and your health insurance companies were taking 30, 35, 40% overhead up until recently. Now, by law, they're taking 25%, 20 and 25%. But still, that's absurd. I mean, why are we giving all this money to basically bankers? That's all they do is they move dollars around. They don't immunize kids. They don't cure diseases. They don't do surgery. They just move money around. They're banksters. Joe, thanks a lot for the call. Coming up tomorrow, is creationist teaching dumbing down students, and does it belong in any official curriculum? Yeah, that's going to be an interesting debate. Plus, Tim Carpenter, Progressive Democrats of America, is going to be dropping by with all the news from the Hill. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It's sport. It starts with you. Get out there. Get active. Occupy something. Tag your edge. See you.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. Solar World has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.